Chapter 4. The electric lights came on, burning spots into Cianne's vision, temporarily blotting out the name Prendi in her hands. The candle flickered. The door hinges creaked.
Cianne,
Emery asked, punctuating her name with a yawn.
What are you? Telegram?
Cianne didn't answer. Her thoughts danced around her family's home and down into the river that had swallowed a buggy and its driver whole, almost claiming Emery and Cianne too. They zoomed east to Dartford, to the paper mill's newly rebuilt walls. Emery's hand touched her shoulder. Handing him the telegram, she turned and walked away, the distance from the telegraph to her bedroom passing beneath her without notice. She flipped on the light. Fennel stirred. She crossed the room to her desk and pulled out a square sheet of white paper and a pencil. She wrote furiously, her words unaligned. She had just started her second sentence when Emery's soft voice asked,
What are you doing?
Warning my family, Cianne quipped.
He doesn't know where they live now, Cianne,
he said, gentle as a summer breeze. He entered the room slowly, his footsteps like a deer's on the forest floor.
And Alfred will make them a priority. He probably already has.
Cianne shook her head. The paper magician's hand found her shoulder again, the fingers curling gently around her.
I'm so sorry,
he whispered. Cianne slammed the pencil onto the desktop, breaking off its point. She turned to Emery and felt tears sting the corners of her eyes.
Why haven't they executed him yet?
She asked. The question burning her tongue.
They've had 2 years! All the people he's hurt!
Emery cupped either side of her face, wiped a thumb under one of her eyes to catch a tear.
They lost Grath and Lyra. Serraj was the only means of obtaining information for the underground.
It doesn't matter!
I'm not disagreeing with you,
he said, voice faint. He pressed his forehead to hers. Cianne dropped her eyes and pulled from his touch, but then leaned forward into his shoulder. He encircled his arms around her, his warmth providing some amount of comfort.
What if he's still after them? Us?
She whispered.
He won't get far. We'll leave it to the cabinet. They'll take care of it.
If we left everything to the cabinet, we'd both be dead.
He stroked her hair.
Regardless, Sarraj's primary concern will be to escape. He has no reason to chase you anymore, and I doubt he cares to torment me. He'll be heading for the coast in hopes of crossing the channel. If Alfred has time to send word to us, we can assume it's because he already has men on Sarraj's tail.
Cianne let out a long breath, trying to wrap Emery's reassurances around her like a warm blanket. She calmed a little. Relaxed, but a ping of worry still warped her pulse. Nothing Serraj did was ever direct or predictable. What if her family still lay in his sights? Grath's voice licked her thoughts as she heard him repeat her mother's and father's names. She shuddered. At least Emery wouldn't be involved in this mess. He hadn't worked with criminal affairs since Saraj's arrest. With his ex-wife out of the picture for good, Emery no longer had a reason to deal with excisioners, and the cabinet had accepted that. She stayed in Emery's arms a moment longer before pulling back. Emery kissed her softly.
I can try to find out more in the morning, if it will help,
he offered.
The best thing we can do now is rest.
And ward the house?
The house is warded.
He managed a faint smile.
You are safe, Cianne. And so are they. I promise.
She nodded. Emery lingered a moment, then pressed his lips to her forehead and excused himself without words. She could stay with him again tonight. To hell with propriety. Still, she decided against asking. She trusted Emery, of course, and she didn't want him to think otherwise. But how could he really know where Serraj Prendi would go and what he would do? Fennel lifted his head and offered a papery bark. Sighing, Cianne picked up her half-finished message and crumpled it in her hands, then tossed it into the dustbin with the command, "Shred." She shut off the lights and climbed into bed, beckoning the paper dog to lie by her head. Yes, the best thing she could do now was sleep. She didn't sleep well.
"Oh, bugger!"
Sienna cried the following afternoon as sour smoke funneled up from the oven door. She waved a dish towel back and forth in a futile attempt to clear the air. Coughing, she pulled open the oven door. Smoke assaulted her and burned her eyes, but Sienna reached through it and pulled out a well-charred brisket, black down to its juice. Hacking, she set the smoking dish on the stove and retreated for the back door, yanking it open and savoring the clean late-spring air. Tendrils of smoke wafted over her head, dissipating into the outdoors. The smell lingered between the cabinets. Leaning against the doorframe, Sienna took several deep breaths, hoping they would clear her head and calm her nerves. She hadn't burned brisket since she was 11. At least Emery wasn't home to witness the catastrophe. He'd gone to Dartford that morning to inspect a new line of paper products designed especially for folders, and he likely wouldn't be home until after dinner. Sienna slid along the doorframe until she crouched at the bottom. Fennel's dry paper tongue licked her knee, but when she didn't respond to him, he hopped outside after the smoke, padding about the lawn with his new rubber feet. They gave more spring to his step, letting him run a little faster, closer to the speed of a flesh-and-blood dog. Sienna rubbed the bridge of her nose, where the cartilage met her forehead. She'd been upstairs reviewing written spells, paper magic accomplished with a pen or pencil, all while writing down next week's grocery list when the burned brisket made itself known with the foul stench of dying food. Having formed a pact with herself that morning to keep busy, she'd barely allotted herself time to use the washroom, and she'd forgotten about the brisket, which she had cooked hours before dinner just to give herself something to do. Now, crouching in the smoke-laced air, her troubled thoughts caught up to her. Emery had taken the telegram, but it didn't matter. Its blocky letters had already inscribed themselves into her mind. Sarraj had loosed himself on the world, and though Sienna would like to believe he would flee England and be done with them, she did not trust it would happen that way. There was something broken inside Sarraj, something crucial. That's what Emery had told her, not long after Grath Cobalt's death. Emery didn't like talking about excisioners, but Sienna had insisted. A sigh escaped her mouth. Yes, the house was warded, but that hadn't stopped Lyra from busting down the front door and ripping Emery's heart from his chest. Paper was a poor repellent to excision. And if Lyra was little more than an apprentice, what horrors could Sarraj dole out? Sienna stood, examining the empty house. Emery picked one hell of a day to leave town. Seems he had restored the spells concealing the house, at least. Snapping her fingers, Sienna beckoned Fennel inside and locked the door, then marched to the front of the house and checked the locks there as well. The windows next. Despite the heat, she locked her window and the library's, even secured the trap door to the roof. As she stepped into her bedroom to resume her studies, her eyes settled on her empty desk chair, knocked askew from her flight to the kitchen. Her fears turned on her, transposing the quivering body of Delilah upon the chair, a gag in her mouth, ropes binding her down. Sienna closed her eyes and rubbed circles over her temples in an attempt to stave off a growing headache. This wasn't fair. She'd never meant for Delilah to be hurt. At least Grath had been buried 6 feet under along with her, though Sienna would have preferred for his grave to be even deeper. Lowering her hands, Sienna studied her palms, imagining the scars that would have marred them, had a nameless excisioner at the hospital not wished them away. She could feel the bite of the glass as it cut into her skin, the pressure in her hands as she stabbed the shard into Grath's torso and shouted, "Shatter!" She didn't feel guilty for killing him. Perhaps she should, but she didn't. Her only remorse was not making it to Magician Avioski's home sooner. If she had arrived before Grath, there was a chance Delilah would still be alive.
"Oh, you would be dead too,"
Emery had said when she related the thought to him, his tone dark. She returned her focus to the chair, only this time she saw her brother Marshall tied to it, not Delilah. Marshall, Zena, Margot, her parents, Emery. It could have been any one of them. It could be any one of them. Tiani pressed her lips together. She hated being the victim. If Saraj did come back, she wouldn't be his. Not her, and not her loved ones. Not when there was a way to protect them. Something she alone could do. Leaving the door ajar, Tiani hurried down the stairs and made her way to Emery's study, where she took several lengths of smooth twine. She revisited the cookbook in the kitchen for her ball of phosphorus, then retreated to her room, shutting the door behind her, despite being the only one home. She sat at her desk and went to work. She measured the twine around her neck and cut it accordingly, then began forming the charms, one by one. She started with the easiest, paper. She snatched up the closest piece of paper, an essay she had written about the history of paper animation. She sliced the top of it off with her smelted scissor and folded a thick starlight. The words, "In 1744, graced the starlight's face. Using a pair of pliers, she looped a piece of wire from a paper clip through one of the starlight's points. Tiani wrapped more wire around a match, which contained both wood and phosphorus and would serve a dual purpose, allowing her to both break her bond to paper as well as strike a flame to bond to fire. Second, she cut a rectangle from one of her sturdier handkerchiefs and, with the supplies from a small sewing kit, stitched up its sides, using a bit of spare twine for an enclosure. She retrieved a jar of fine gaffer's sand from the back of her bottom desk drawer and poured a tablespoon of the sand into the tiny bag and set it aside. She picked up her makeup compact, the one Delilah had given her, and held the handles of her pliers over it, but hesitated. Several seconds passed. She set the compact inside and instead went downstairs, selecting a glass cup from the cupboards. Back in her room, she chipped a shard from its rim and wound it in wire. She wrapped up the phosphorus next and strung three more matches together, ensuring she could loosen one at a moment's notice. Tiani leaned back in her chair and rolled her head, hearing her neck crack too many times to count. After flexing and unflexing her fingers, she started on the more difficult charms. She pierced wire through a spare rubber button, stole a bronze bead from a bracelet, and threaded twine through a small wing of melting plastic she had purchased in town at the beginning of the year when she had studied polymaking. She'd given up on the plastic-based magic after making Fennel's skeleton, however. Being the most recently discovered material magic, there were few spells Tiani could find that didn't require molds and plastic welding kits. Siping with rubber and polymaking with plastics had been her more recent studies, merely because finding samples of their natural substance proved far trickier than the rest. She had done a great deal of research and dealt with a fair number of peddlers who didn't take her seriously, as she was neither a siper nor a polymaker most days, and she dared not claim otherwise. But enough prodding and investigation had paid off, and she had samples of the materials she needed to bond to both materials. She searched the house for half an hour, trying to find a vial smaller than the one half filled with almond extract in the kitchen. Then she remembered the perfume samples her sister Zena had given her. She dumped the weakest-smelling one and rinsed out the tiny vial, then pulled a fist-sized jug of oil, only somewhat different from the substance that ran through the engine of an automobile, from the back of her bottom desk drawer. She carefully poured a few drops into the perfume vial, corked the vial tightly, and wound it up with wire. Another item she had stashed in the drawer was liquid latex, which had come in a bottle small enough for her purposes. This had been the hardest natural substance for her to find, and explaining why she needed it had proven a chore. She wound it in wire, then retrieved a pure silver spoon from the same drawer. The spoon, albeit tarnished, was her magic wand for breaking the smelting bond. She took the tip of the spoon's handle in her pliers and bent it back and forth until the soft metal snapped. She wound the belled portion in wire and topped it with a hook. She strung her handiwork along the twine, forming a haphazard necklace, memorizing the placement of each item. She secured the twine and slipped it over her head, careful not to scrape herself on the glass and broken silver. Her back ached, but she felt accomplished. With this, she could be ready for anything. Saraj might have had power over flesh and blood, but she had power over everything else. Sini checked the clock. There was still time. After hiding the necklace beneath her blouse, Sini packed a small bag and snatched her bicycle, ready to make the long ride into town. It was time to visit Magician Avioski.